December 7th, 1941. A date which will live in infamy. With those unforgettable words, President Roosevelt shocked the nation when he announced on a Sunday morning that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and hundreds of U.S. servicemen were dead. And anyone who lived through that morning would never forget the announcement that we were at war. More recently, there is another date which lives in infamy. The numbers 9/11 have been forever etched into the collective American consciousness as a date when once again we were attacked, and once more a date beginning a war, the war on terror. But for those who love and fear God and therefore who respect life, there is still another infamous date. And it is one that marks the beginning of another war, one that has claimed more victims than all the wars of all of the history of the entire human race combined. And that date is January 22nd, 1973. Because it was on that date that the United States Supreme Court, in its landmark decision in the case of Roe versus Wade and the companion case of Doe versus Bolton, declared that the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, does not include the unborn. Now, you remember, of course, the 14th Amendment was adopted to amend the United States Constitution in order to overturn the Dred Scott decision, which had legalized slavery. And the 14th Amendment states that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Oh, but the politically motivated majority on the court, seeking to impose its own social agenda on the rest of the nation, against all historical and legal and moral precedent, in an act of supreme arrogance and rank judicial tyranny, declared that the unborn are not persons, and so fully and finally legalized abortion on demand in our nation. Justice Harry Blackmun has become infamous. His legacy has become writing the majority decision in Roe v. Wade. He is either celebrated or vilified. Writing the majority decision for a case, the profound implications of which are simply staggering, brethren, to contemplate. But I want to try to get us to contemplate that, to help us to understand that since that decision in 1973, for a child in America, the most dangerous place to be is her mother's womb. Let me at least try to impress upon our minds the magnitude of this atrocity that has legalized abortion on demand in our nation. And I'd like to do that by means of analogy. Consider with me, for example, the casualties of war that we have experienced as a nation over the years. And as you look at this material, remember that each X you see represents 50,000. And as you're looking at that and thinking about that, remember too how we're hearing even now, every day, of more of our young men, our soldiers in Iraq, who are being killed. And we might hear of a few today and then six or 10 more tomorrow. And there's this tremendous concern over that. A dozen lives lost. There's outrage. And I think we've forgotten in our nation that freedom isn't free and that a high price has always had to be paid in order to have freedom. But you look at the casualties of war, but now consider the casualties of the war on the unborn. And let me remind you again that each X you see represents 50,000 children. They don't all fit on one slide. Never to laugh, never to love, never to live in this life. Since 1973, over 40 million, brethren, that's nearly seven times the number of Jews who were butchered by the Nazis in the Holocaust of World War II. If you were to take the names of all of these children and put them on the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial in Washington, it would fill that wall not just 10 times or even 100 times over, but 700 times over. Over 4,000 every day. That's more than died in the towers and in the Pentagon and on the planes on September 11th. Every single day. Over a million per year. Since 1973, that's one child for every three born. Legalized abortion on demand is the American Holocaust. It is, brethren, a tragedy of profound proportions, and I want to suggest unto you that it is the most significant moral issue of our day. And that means we are duty-bound to address it. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5, Paul said that we're to cast down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And the same apostle told us by the Spirit of Christ, reprove the unfruitful works of darkness, Ephesians 5 and verse 11. Brethren, let's not stand with the apathetic or be numbered among the cowardly who feel no sense of obligation, no urgency to cry out, afraid or indifferent to warn and to inform and to persuade and to act in this critical matter of life and death. We've titled this lesson simply Coping with Abortion. I would like to say before we proceed further that, as Rick already suggested, this is a sensitive issue. We acknowledge that. And we want to recognize, too, that in an audience like this, it's possible that someone present has had an abortion. It may be that you have loved ones who are suffering from the guilt of having had abortions. And what few people realize is how many women who have had abortions suffer the devastating effects of what's called post-abortion syndrome. Studies show that among women who have aborted, there are higher rates of depression and substance abuse. And what abortion proponents hide from the public with the complicity of the media is that most women, if not virtually all, who have had abortions carry deep emotional scars and struggle with guilt and fear the rest of their lives. Listen, those women don't need our condemnation. They need our compassion. They need to understand, as all do, that because of the grace of God and the love of Jesus Christ, that any sin can be forgiven. If we will humble ourselves and surrender to the gospel of Jesus Christ, that burden of guilt can be lifted and we can have peace with God. That being said, brethren, at the same time, we should be angry, righteously indignant over the efforts of those who defend and promote abortion, those who are deceiving the public, who despise righteousness and are destroying women and children. You know, Mark 3 and verse 5, we're told Jesus looked round about on him in anger, being grieved for the hardness of the hearts of the Jews. Be angry and sin not, Ephesians 4, 26. In Acts 17, 6, when Paul entered into the city of Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he beheld the city full of idolatry. And when we see the blood of innocent children flowing red in the streets, and if we are not stirred in our own souls, if we're not provoked in our own spirits, there is something seriously wrong. Both compassion and righteous anger. Let's talk about, first of all, brethren, what the real question is in this whole controversy. What is the real issue? This is a deeply dividing, intensely emotional issue, and it's difficult to get people to think clearly and rationally about it. And I found that's true even with those who claim to be Christians and even among our own brethren. You know, we constantly hear the rhetoric of choice, and we hear the response to that. We're hearing all the time of women's rights. We're constantly exposed to this rhetoric of freedom of choice and reproductive freedom. The National Abortion Rights Action League, Planned Parenthood, the nation's largest abortion provider, the ACLU, the NOW, and others, they consider themselves to be champions of women's rights. And the terminology we use here is critical, because through the use of carefully selected terminology, the pro-abortionists have been successful in deceiving people and in diverting attention away from what the real issue is. You know, the leftist mainstream media creates a subtle prejudice in the minds of men by refusing to refer to us as pro-life. Instead, they say anti-abortion, which has a harsh and threatening and pejorative ring to it. While on the other hand, they don't refer to pro-abortionists as pro-abortion. They don't refer to them as anti-life, but as pro-choice. And that suggests a reasonable concern for individual freedoms that rings true in people's hearts. You know, pro-abortion politicians sometimes avoid even using the word abortion. We'll hear them stand up and say, you know, I will defend a woman's right to choose. Well, choose to do what? Well, that they're not going to say explicitly, just because of the negative connotation sometimes even of the word abortion. But by framing the discussion over abortion in terms of women's rights, they've been able to divert attention away from what the real issue is, brethren. And you know, let me just say this too. When it comes to all this rhetoric of choice and the self professed champions of women's rights, let the truth be known here, brethren. They don't want women to really make an informed choice. They don't want women to know about the dangers of abortion. They don't want women to know or to be required by law to be informed about the traumatic effects it can have on their emotional well-being. They don't want women to be required by law to be given information about prenatal development. They oppose the rights of the father to have any say in whether his child lives or dies. They oppose parental consent laws for minors, or even informed consent laws, even laws rather requiring that minors inform their parents so that they can make the right choice. It's not about choice. The abortionists don't want women to make the choice that is best for them. While we would acknowledge that some activists in the pro-abortion camp might believe at one point that they are acting out of genuine concern for women, but make no mistake about it, most are driven by an anti-Christian ideology. And behind it all, something looms large and sinister, and it is money. It is ludicrous to think that the multi-billion dollar abortion industry is concerned about women. That is a heinous and satanic lie. But the semantic gymnastics used to justify abortion simply divert attention away from the question, which is sort of like the elephant standing in the middle of the room that everyone's trying to act like it isn't there. And that is abortion the taking of innocent human life? And then the related question, is a fetus a living human being? And that brings us then ultimately to the foundational question, is when does human life begin? And a corollary concern even to that is, when do we have the right to take human life? Do we ever have the right to take it? And if so, under what circumstances? But brethren, to be effective in this battle for the unborn and in the war for the minds of men, we have to get people to focus on the real issue. When does life begin? Let's answer that question by looking at two basic points. First of all, the scientific evidence, and then the biblical evidence. The scientific evidence. Now, I realize, brethren, this is not a biology class. But remember that God is creator. We were just singing about that, those who are here for the singing before the evening session tonight. Our God, He is alive. From dust our God created man. And remember that God as creator has revealed Himself in the creation. We can discover important truth about reality through the revelation of God in creation as well as the revelation of God in Scripture, through both general and special revelation. And when we look at that scientific evidence, we find overwhelming testimony which proves beyond any doubt that life begins at conception. That what you have in the joining of the element from the man and from the woman is a unique individual, a unique and distinctive genetic code, an individual that is dependent upon the mother at that stage for its existence, but which is nevertheless separate from both mother and father. And brethren, modern technology has allowed us to peer into the womb and look at the early stages of life in the very early period of human development. Here you see the fully formed little feet of a baby at the stage of 10 weeks in the womb. And some of you have those precious feet pins and the little hands, too, that you can wear as a pro-life statement. And again, because of modern technology, we're able to peer into the womb and see the development of human life and the characteristics of the human body and reveal that what you have there is not some indistinct glob of flesh, but that you have this child. And in fact, here you see in the stages of development that even very early on, before many women even know there's a child within them, that all body systems are present at 8 weeks, that the child can suck her thumb, can even grip an instrument when it's inserted into the womb at 10 weeks. The structure of the body is completely formed. And what you're seeing before you right now is a baby at 15 weeks, just 4 inches. Imagine holding that in your hand and having it fit just in the tips of your finger, having that a precious little human life there. And notice too, at that stage can even make facial expressions. In fact, I was able to obtain an image from Eric's sonogram when he was a child, and he even signaled back to the sonographer. And, you know, even at that age, but you know, the power of this evidence should not be underestimated. We need to expose people to it. Here you see at 18 weeks, a baby in the womb, 20 weeks. And on we could go. I wish we had more time to focus on the scientific evidence and the importance of it, the significance of it. But we can at least make some summary comments here that at 4 months, the baby is fully functioning. In fact, just a couple of weeks later, the child is sometimes viable, can survive independently outside the womb. And in fact, here this child you see is at the stage of 6 months. And in fact, what we're finding then is that from conception, all you have is the baby developing and growing. He needs only time and nourishment to become an adult. What you have in the birth process is not a change in fundamental nature. All you have in birth, if you want to look at it this way, is a change in place of residence and a change in dining habits. But there is nothing in the process of birth that transforms what is in the womb into a living human being that was a few moments before something less or other than that. Now, pro-abortionists don't like to focus on this kind of evidence because they know the power that it has to persuade women. And that's why they oppose laws requiring women to see sonograms before they have abortions. But even the major secular media, the mainstream media, has called attention to the way that this kind of technology really is turning men's hearts. Look at this recent issue of Newsweek, how science is changing the debate. And it detailed in its pages the new 4D real-time sonogram technology and set forth the various stages. And I want you to notice a statement that was made here in connection with that article. The text states that the Peterson murder case and changing state laws and startling new science are causing many Americans to rethink long-held beliefs. Should we not be utilizing that startling new science and focusing on these state laws and these controversial cases to change long-held beliefs? Now, pro-abortionists try to depersonalize what is in the womb and hide what we've just seen and what is so obvious to anyone who will be honest about it. They like to remove the humanity and the personhood of what is within the womb of the unborn by using the term fetus, or speaking instead of a child within the woman as instead saying the product of conception. And instead of saying abortion, they'll simply say pregnancy termination. Think about that for a minute. The word fetus is simply a Latin term which means infant or child. It's perfectly acceptable. But how many times do we say to someone who is pregnant, you know, a husband and wife excited about their baby on the way, how many times we hear them say, "Oh, honey, come here, I just felt the fetus move." Or how many times you say, "Well, have you picked out a name for the product of conception? How is the fetus room coming along? Are you going to paint it in primary colors? We've got some product of conception diapers we're going to get you at the fetus shower that we're going to have next month for you." You know, we don't use that terminology. People only use that terminology when they want us to think that what is there is something other than a baby. They want us to believe that abortion is merely the removal of tissue, but is that what this evidence shows? It puts the lie to the idea that the abortionist is just removing a mass of flesh. An abortion doctor, Sheldon Turkish, was asked by a woman named Rosa Acuna. Before she had an abortion, she asked him, "Was the baby already there?" And he said, "Nothing but some blood." Later, when she was exposed to this kind of material, she sued for malpractice. But a trial court threw the case out because of the way Roe v. Wade defines personhood. Later, a New Jersey appellate court overturned that decision and ordered a trial. But listen, the point is, women and our daughters are being lied to. What this evidence shows is that the only difference between killing a child in the womb and a child in a crib is that the child in the crib is older. Do you remember all the outrage over Andrea Yates when she killed her children? But her only problem was she waited too long. She waited till the children had reached a stage of development that was beyond what is legally acceptable. But really, what she did and what these girls have done, leaving their babies, newborn children in trash bins and in dumpsters, what they're doing appalls the public, but it's no different than what is happening thousands of times every day in abortion clinics across the nation. And the scientific evidence shows that, but so does the biblical evidence. Let's talk about what we find in the Word of God, because all you're seeing from science is the corroboration of what the Bible has said all along. And we can focus, first of all, on our Savior Himself. What about Jesus? You know, Matthew chapter 1, verse 18 says, Mary was with child. She wasn't with tissue. She wasn't with a mass of flesh, but she was with child. And think of this. Was there ever a time when Jesus was neither man nor God, but merely a collection of inhuman cells? Now, when you look further into the Word of God in connection with our Savior, you find in Luke chapter 1, verse 41, we often point this out, that the text says the babe, Rephos, leaped in her womb. Speaking of John when he was still in the womb of Elizabeth. But then later, the shepherds at night were told that they could go and find Jesus as a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger. The same word was used of what was in the womb and what was out. The only difference is the location and the size and the development. But the same terminology is used of what is within the woman and what comes out at birth and is placed in swaddling clothes and set in that crib. We have texts elsewhere, a classic one in Psalm 139, which speak of the humanity of the unborn, where David said of himself, "For you formed my inward parts and you covered me. Not what had the potential to be me, not what might become me, but you covered me in my mother's womb, and I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. For my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth." That's a Hebrew idiom for the womb. God skillfully wrought David within the womb. And he said, "Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed." Oh, at early stages, it might not appear to have what we would consider to be distinctly human form, but still, a human living being is there. And David said, "In your book, they were all written the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them." And we could add to that Jeremiah 1:5 and other passages as well. But what we're seeing is the simple truth that since life begins at conception, since what we have in the womb is a living human being, then abortion is not a woman's right. Then abortion is murder. It is the taking without divine authority of innocent human life. Brethren, to support it, to defend it, to promote it, to refuse to oppose it, is to be then an accessory to murder. You cannot be a faithful Christian and claim that God gives a woman a right to kill her unborn child. I'd like to talk with you now, though, about something I'd simply call the madness of abortion. The gross inconsistencies of our pro-abortion culture. Did you know, for example, that in some states, 12 or 13-year-old girls can be taken to abortion clinics during school hours and given abortion? And in some cases, these girls have been injured. In a few cases, they've even died. But their parents do not even have to consent or even be informed. And yet, behold, wonder of wonders, that same child cannot get so much as an aspirin without prior written parental consent. Now, if this young 12 or 13-year-old girl is injured during the abortion, which often happens, and there is bleeding requiring surgery to save her life, that surgery can't be done without parental consent. But the abortion can be done to begin with without mom or dad knowing. Now you tell me, that's not insane. There's nothing that demonstrates the monstrosity and the insanity of abortion any more than the legalization of partial birth abortion. Now, I thought long and prayed about how to approach this. I'm trying to be sensitive to the fact that we have young children in the audience and parents who might not want them to be exposed too explicitly to a description of what this is, so I removed some images that I had here, and I'm trying to be delicate about it. But essentially what partial birth abortion is, brethren, it's a procedure done on children in the very late stages of abortion, even up to a moment before delivery. But it's a late stage abortion procedure in which a child is turned in the womb and delivered feet first, all but the head. And then I won't go further in describing how grisly and gruesome what the abortion butcher does next. But essentially, the child is almost fully delivered from the birth canal before it is killed, so that it can be brought out of the birth canal without dilating the mother. Now, even some rank abortion supporters in the United States Congress labeled this exactly what it is, infanticide. Even they couldn't stomach it. And twice during the Clinton administration, a ban on partial birth abortion was passed. And twice, President Clinton vetoed that ban. He was a great friend to the abortion industry and to the pro-abortion radicals who are trying to take our culture straight down to the pit of hell. And if you voted for him, I hope you're ashamed of that. Now, when President Bush was elected, he said that he would sign a ban on partial birth abortion if it would be brought to his desk. But because of Tom Daschle and leading Democrats in the Senate, that bill never came to a vote while the Democrats had the majority in the Senate. They blocked it. In the 2002 election, the Republicans gained the Senate back. And so the bill reached the desk of the president, and in a historic moment, he signed the ban on partial birth abortion, a ban which would have never taken place under a different and prior administration. Now, let me say this, brethren, not all Republicans are pro-life. I wouldn't have voted for Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was pro-abortionist, though he was a Republican. Not all Democrats are pro-abortion. There are a few who stand against it. But as a party, the Democrats stand with the pro-abortionists. There is a plank in their platform that they will defend the so-called woman's right to choose. And we're going to talk more about that later. The problem here is, though, that it was challenged in the courts, and now we're in a situation where once more judges can overturn the will of the people. You see, what abortionists cannot accomplish through the legislative or democratic process, they seek to accomplish through the court, circumventing the will of the people, using ungodly judges to impose their culture of death on the rest of us. Thankfully, under the current administration, recently the Born Alive Infants Protection Act was passed. What is that? It makes illegal the refusal or the failure to submit life-saving aid to babies that are born alive. Why did we need that law? Because before that law, babies who were accidentally born in the process of being given abortions were left on the table to die. And so it's all right to kill the baby if it's within the womb, but if the baby accidentally is brought out of the womb, now you can no longer leave the child to sit there to die by exposure. And just recently, we had the Unborn Victims of Violence Act passed and signed into law by President Bush. And we don't agree with everything President Bush has done. We're not endorsing him officially as the church, but we're acknowledging the good that has been done by those who respect life. This is called Lacey and Connor's Law, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. Now, because of that law, at the federal level, when a pregnant woman is killed, if her unborn child is also killed, then there are two murders prosecutable. A man is prosecutable for having committed two murders. Now, abortionists oppose this because they saw the implications that it had. They said it's wrong to give rights to a fetus at any stage. But they didn't oppose it too vocally because they realized the public is sympathetic to Lacey Peterson, to her family's plight, and what happened to little Connor. They realize where the public stands on crimes like that. And people can see that an unborn child is a human being in a case like that. They can understand that if Scott Peterson killed his wife, then he also murdered his unborn son. Well, we need to get people to think and ask, well, then why isn't an abortionist committing murder when he does the same thing? You remember little Samuel Aramis, this famous picture that was taken. Surgery was performed on him at 21 weeks in utero. Here you see his finger clutching the hand of the surgeon. I've tried to highlight that for you. This image was suppressed in the mainstream media because they knew the impact that that would have on people's thinking about abortion. Later, little Samuel was born. Here you see him newly born and at 5 months old, but you realize that had his mother changed her mind while they were performing that in utero surgery to save that little baby's life, had she changed her mind and said, "No, I want you to kill the child," that would have been perfectly legal. Now, if instead of performing the surgery to save the life of little Samuel in the womb, the doctor had, without the mother's consent, killed that child, he would have been guilty of murder. What is the difference? The will of the mother. If she wants the child to live, then injuring her or doing anything to take the life of that child is murder. But if she doesn't want the child, then it may be disposed of lawfully. Are we willing to accept the implications of legal circumstance whereby we are going to say that whether or not an entity is a living human being which deserves the protection of the law depends on whether or not someone else wants it? That's what gave us Dachau and Auschwitz and Treblinka. That is the stench of Hitler's ovens. What is it that gives you your right to life? What is it that gives you your value? It's the fact that you were created in the image of Almighty God. From dust our God created man. Now, if evolution is true, if we merely have come to be by purely natural processes over millions of years, then we're nothing but a configuration of chemicals. And killing an unborn child or any person at all would be no more morally significant than crushing a bug underfoot. That's why it matters what people believe about origins. And that's why really behind this and all other moral issues is the ultimate issue of the nature of human life and the origin of human life. But you see, what gives you your value is not what you look like or how healthy or how sick you are or whether or not you're handicapped, how limited you might be physically or mentally. That's not what gives you your worth, whether or not you're wanted. Even if there were not another single person on the face of the earth who wanted you to live, your soul is still precious and valuable. In fact, so precious that God gave His only begotten Son to die on your behalf. The cross of Jesus Christ, what took place on the hill of Calvary, is the ultimate testimony. It is the ultimate measure of the worth of a single, solitary human being. That is God saying, "I want you, I love you, even if your own mother doesn't want you. You are valuable to me." It's the fact that we are the offspring of God, brethren, that gives us the right to life. You know, with all this talk about rights and freedom, I'd like to suggest something to you. It might be a bit radical for our country. I don't know if our nation would be willing to hear it. But we hold these truths to be self-evident. That all men are created equal. And that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When President Bush signed that ban on partial birth abortion, he made some statements that well reflect the point that we're making here. He said, "America stands for liberty, for the pursuit of happiness, and for the unalienable right of life." He went on to add that the most basic duty of government is to defend the life of the innocent. And he said, "Every person, however frail or vulnerable, has a place and purpose in this world. Every person has a special dignity. And this right to life cannot be granted or denied by government because it does not come from government. It comes from the Creator of life. That's what the Bible has been saying all along. Now, we only have a moment or two for me to offer you some thoughts about what we can do about this and understand that we must do what we can do about it. I'd like to sober you with a passage from Proverbs in chapter 24, 11 and 12. And I'd like to thank Travis Gerhart for letting me have that picture of him when he was a baby to use for this. But the text says, "Deliver those who are being taken away to death, and those who are staggering to the slaughter, oh, hold them back." If you say, "See, we did not know this," does he not consider it who weighs the hearts? And does he not know it who keeps your soul? And will he not render to man according to his work? Let me paraphrase. Do we think that we're going to escape the judgment of God? If we do and say nothing to stop the slaughter of innocent human beings? If so, think again. What can we do? Well, should we take gun in hand like Paul Hill did? A Presbyterian minister, I believe it was for the Presbyterian Church, for a major denominational group, and he killed in cold blood an abortionist and his bodyguard. Is that what the Lord would have us to do? He was just executed in Florida, the first murderer of an abortionist to be executed in our country. Is that what is going to help save unborn lives? Well, you know the answer to that question. But what can we do, brethren? We can pray. Are you praying daily and diligently for the unborn? We need to pray that we would have judges on our courts who would uphold the rule of law, who would respect life, who would fear God and judge righteous judgment. We need to pray for our leaders, as Paul said in 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 and following. Brethren, let's be fervent in prayer over this issue. We need to inform, and that means we need to be informed. The things that we've talked about tonight, we need to talk to people about them. We need to be writing about them. I think we should be taking out full-page ads in major newspapers across the country. I think we should be getting on the airwaves, on television, through mail-outs and every means possible. Many people don't even understand what is taking place. But brethren, we also need to use our freedom as good stewards.